Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program of commentary from a Christian viewpoint. This is Elizabeth Cuppett-Caverly, and a little bit later we'll be joined by Lou Caverly. We're talking again about the possibility of severe climate change coming, and it isn't global warming. It is an ice age. We'll be talking about this, and if this is true, as the years ahead bring us a lot more challenges in winter and a lot of changing weather, we'll need each other more. We'll need to be as healthy as we all can be, and that even includes the elite. I can't think that all of them are like the crazy top percent who are implementing these terrible things on us, like the vaccines, like the GMO foods, all of this, because I think some of them realize they can never fully escape these forces if they're let loose on the world with no regulatory powers, because things tend to go more chaotic once chaos comes. It isn't really order ab chao, ordo ab chao. It's really like chao ab chao. Looking at things today, we hear there's some breaking news about some emails that Hillary Clinton did, and if this proceeds to come out, this is probably going to dampen her chances of being president, just the way it took the EPA head out, if these illegal emails are there. So much is connected to this Islamic business that we just can't imagine the Saudi connection. The Saudi connection is very, very important. And you know it's important when even globalist publication Time Magazine, February 23rd to March 2nd, had Joe Klein writing, "With friends like these, it's time for an honest conversation about Saudi Arabia and the roots of Islamist terrorism." So, getting into this, we can realize that Saudi Arabia is really funding a lot of the jihadist things, and they have great power, and they have been our compatriot. So that 9/11, all of us, nothing is the way it really seems. And even Joe Klein says, quote, "And the wellspring of Salafism," and Salafism, he talks about, I think this is the radical movement that he claims on the Sunni side began, quote, "in the late 19th century, also as a reaction to Western imperialism and ideas. It has become a powerful strand of thought in the Arab world." Quote, "We have a serious internal debate in one of the world's three great monotheisms," says Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, quote, "It has to be faced head on." Klein says, "It is fine to call the ISIS adherents thugs and gangsters, but they are also Muslims." Quote, "Of course this is an Islamic issue," quote, end of quote. Hayden continues, quote, "It's not about Muslims or even the vast majority," quote, "but reactionary Islamic radicalism, militant Salafism, is the source of the ongoing violence." And then Klein says, "And the wellspring of Salafism is Saudi Arabia's extreme expansionist Wahhabi Islamic sect. Part of the reason Obama can't utter the words Islamic radicals is that we have not been able to have an honest conversation about our Arabian ally. The Saudi royal family is a source of stability in the region, and under the late King Abdullah, it was a mild force for reform, especially in education. But the Saudi elites have funded not just al-Qaeda, but also radical madrasas throughout the Islamic world. They do it cleverly, privately, through, quote, charitable institutions. The impact has been enormous. In the 1990s, I asked Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan how her country had changed in the previous 25 years. Quote, I used to be able to go out on the street wearing jeans and without a headscarf, she said. I asked her why she couldn't do that now. The Saudis, she replied immediately, a reference to the Saudi-funded madrasas that were rapidly replacing the ineffective public schools in her country. The Taliban came out of those madrasas just as a great many of the ISIS criminals do now. And Klein even goes on to mention that, quote, both Presidents Bush were way too close to the royal family. There is a secret section of a report by congressional intelligence committees that may relate to the Saudi role in the attacks, and that concerns 911, we interject. He says that section should be made public now. as an ongoing suit by the families of 9/11 victims has demanded. If we are going to continue to donate American lives in the fight, and sadly we must, he says, you see, to protect our country from terrorist attacks, we need to be clear about exactly who the enemy is. Of course, on this program, we don't endorse his last statement. We don't want ground troops in there. We don't want our young men fed as cattle fodder to the international interests that want to foment these wars. Also, Georgianne Geyer, the columnist, weighs in. She says, the roots of today's conflict, and I quote here in part, the former colonies. So she's talking about, I think I'll start here, though. Remember those heady days? World War I was to be the war to end wars. When World War II ended, we still bathed in some of that idealistic thought. The boys had come home, including my beloved brother, who nearly died in the Battle of the Bulge, and a new world beckoned. In the Middle East, we barely noticed that the Ottoman Empire of Turkey had folded up in 1920, making homeless many of the young it had contained. The poor societies of Africa, Asia, and the Middle East had not gained by the war, and now they were poised for independence. Britain gave India and Pakistan independence. France, its colonies in Africa, the Caribbean, and Asia, except for Algeria and Indochina. And Belgium and Italy went home from Africa. But this new freedom was far from the splendid thing imagined by the colonies' long-dominated subjects. The former colonies now became known with a derisive flourish as, quote, the Third World. After the First, and that, she says, is the U.S. and its allies, and the Second, the USSR and its allies. With no experience in governing themselves, most fell into bloody dictatorships. Quote, independence was a Pandora's box. Across this enormous post-colonial part of the world, human beings had now been doubly uprooted, first when the colonists destroyed the tribal and clan structures that had developed over centuries, second, when freed of the colonists, they found themselves with no systems of government and no faith or ideology to inspire them. The next generations of young men became the desolate and desperate boys in the slums of the Third World. I remember well conversation with a particularly adept American ambassador to the Sultanate of Oman about 15 years ago. Only 4% of the world's investment is going into the Middle East, he told me in Muscat. But millions of boys are coming out of the Arab universities every year, and there's no place for them to go. It was an astute warning. In the adjoining years, from 1979 to 1989, the Soviets invaded and occupied Afghanistan, but the United States successfully armed the Mujahideen. Unfortunately, when the Russians left, the U.S. left too, leaving still another group to fuel the Islamic State. The Soviet Union and its ideological world empire collapsed formally in 1991. We rejoiced prematurely, because now there were more young men and women across the world without faith and without purpose. And then she goes on, this is Georgianne Geyer, to note that a lot of the countries that weren't threatened by disintegration or doing so much massacring by the Islamists were Oman and the Gulf states, Morocco, Jordan, and a few others, because their leaders had remained more stable under the Islamic religion, so they didn't have to have their legitimacy questioned. So colonialism helped to bring a lot of this on. She said in Africa, one of the few nations not formally colonized, Botswana, whose intact tribal structures work well, also has historic legitimacy. Meanwhile, our beloved country was denying the great victories of World War II by fighting adventurous and illegitimate wars in Vietnam and then Iraq and Afghanistan. Now we are about to fight again against the Islamic State, which we actually created in this, quote, new world, first by abandoning the Afghan Mujahideen and second by abandoning the Iraq army when we occupied Iraq. That, in too fast a narrative, is how I see the roots of the conflicts we face today. The most important thing, as always, is to understand where we've been, then we can figure out where to go. Well, we hope and pray that the global elite aren't crazy enough to be engineering another raging conflict in the Middle East. But we get these reports that make us question. Jihadi John, raised in UK, reports say, why do things always go back to the intelligence organizations, the CIA, the Mossad, the MI6? All of these groups are playing their role to bring us into the New World Order. And then we had the Turkish military going into Syria to evacuate and try to protect some soldiers who were guarding an Ottoman tomb and remove the remains. Amid fears, the shrine was threatened by Islamic State militants. This was February 23rd in the AP. Well, all well and good, but what about Nineveh? What about the Christian roots? We aren't really seeing them defended, aren't we? We would have to hope that some of you heard a very important interview on True News. And I have to make sure I have my date right here. Let me just pause for a moment. I believe we are looking at, it was March the 4th. So if you would try to go to the archives of truenews.com, you would hear three speakers from the National Religious Broadcasters Association who met last week. And two of them were former Islamic religion people. One was a man, and the second one was a woman. And their stories, their life stories were unforgettable, how they came out of Islam and how they became Christian. Then the third speaker was Dr. Erwin Lutzer, who has written a book about Hitler and the church and the cross. And he had some very profound things to say. That it is this vacuum in our church, the church that isn't really real. It isn't dynamic. It isn't really true to the biblical doctrine. This is when the mosques come in to take over a country. He says this is when Islam has always advanced. So we are all crying out for repentance and renewal in our Christian faith. And when I said if we're going into this colder climate change, we have to look out for each other and we have to be as healthy as we can. And there was some good news. We heard today that the McDonald's chain will no longer serve chickens that are fed antibiotics. That's very, very good news. And then we heard something about possibly Breyers and maybe some other ice cream companies who want to remove the RBGH. And that's the recombinant bovine growth hormone that in the 1990s, health food stores and people, you know, who were really looking out for our health, they were really lamenting what Europe would not implement. But we did here in the 1990s, putting these terrible RBGH things into the cattle. And there were reports about sore udders on the cattle and pus coming out. And we have to think, would we really want that in our bodies? I don't think so. So we have to follow through on this, so you'll want to check this out. If it is Breyers, if they have said they will no longer put the RBGH in their ice cream, this is very, very good. So we would urge you to buy organic milk. We've heard that some of the organic milk companies are not what they appear to be, because they have huge, huge farms. So you have to really look into it. We think that one is Organic Valley that is okay. We think that's good, their products, their butter, their milk. But there are some others you have to be very careful about. And at the same time, there are the forces trying to keep us ill as we want to stay well. And we have all these celebrity big shots out pushing these products on us. I'm tired of seeing Fred Thompson push the kinds of mortgages that are going to harm older people. We see it time after time after time. And then we see Judith Light of Who's the Boss fame. And remember, she was a household word there in that little sitcom. But she says it's so important to get the super shot. Now, what is a super shot? This was in one of the Sunday newspaper supplements. And the super shot is a new higher-dose flu vaccine. And this was supposed to be really targeted to the older people. And they said that you'll make it through the season without taking a sick day, according to the National Council on Aging and COA. And it has teamed up with Judith Light of Who's the Boss fame to get the word out, particularly people ages 65 and over and their caregivers. So she says, quote, "I just turned 65 and I'm busier than ever," says Light, now starring in TNT's reboot of Dallas and the new Amazon series Transparent. "I need to stay healthy and can't let the flu slow me down." The higher dose vaccine contains four times the antigen of the standard flu vaccine and is recommended for people who have weakened immune systems, common with age. A recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that the super shot offered up to 25% more protection for adults over 65. Well, yes, hear that propaganda. At the same time, later we heard the reports that once again the flu shot wasn't applicable to the type of flu that we had, and especially this super shot, this extra super dose of whatever is in the vaccine targeted to the people who are more sickly, the ones over 65 and their caregivers. Really makes you heart sick. But there is some blowback. And, you know, it's really wonderful that this even was in the AP amid backlash. And this was after a lot of demonization of the anti-vaccine proponents by magazines, global magazines like Time Magazine, who talked about the, you know, the stupidity of these people, the movie stars and all of this and all of that. But here it was. There was this article, amid the backlash, the vaccine skeptics explained their position. And there was a picture of a woman with her twin daughters. And, you know, she just said that she had looked into everything quite a bit. And she's an MBA graduate who runs an agriculture-related business. And she had realized that she took a medication herself that was supposedly safe for malaria, and instead, this drug saddled her with multiple health complications. She questions whether the government knew about the risks at the time. And so health officials now acknowledge larium can cause severe side effects, some of which can be permanent. So this began to break her trust in the medical establishment, and she began to do a lot of research on vaccines. So when she got pregnant, they delayed the immunization for her twins. She said it was not an easy decision. The thought of something happening to them because we chose not to vaccinate is terrifying. But I have so many questions, and I do think it's the right decision for our family. And then another woman from Spokane, Washington, said people who share her opinions, quote, are being vilified and ostracized. So the people are beginning to speak up. People are beginning to know that there are some ominous events going on, and some of these are orchestrated. Sandy Hook hasn't gone away. No, today Wolfgang Albig was on the Alex Jones show, and he was discussing the lawsuit that has been filed again and the strange anomalies. One of the strangest. And Lou, welcome to the program. Lou Caverly, my husband.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Good to be with you.
Well, Lou, today a caller called in to Alex Jones, and one of the most, I thought, interesting things brought up was the fact that there have been no lawsuits by the so-called parents of these murdered children at Sandy Hook. There have been no lawsuits against, you know, the school or anything like that, only against gun makers. Do you think that's strange?
I think that's very strange. Anytime there's a crisis like this, a tragedy, there are always some people that will bring about a lawsuit, sometimes for money, but other times just to see justice done. And to see that there are no lawsuits except these that are playing into the hands of the gun grabbers, that's pretty strange to me. I don't think that that's just by accident, if you ask me. Sure doesn't seem that way.
And now, when we're talking about this world in which we may have to have more brotherhood really, and I mean that in a good sense, the type of community where I grew up. And it didn't start with Hillary Clinton's pronouncement that it takes a village to raise a child. I lived that. I experienced that in a little town in Pennsylvania that had its centennial in 1948. And I was a small child at that time, and I rode on a float, and I did something with a spinning wheel. I have a vague memory of this. And my father, who really was always a civic leader, and he was a promoter of things, he got in touch with KDKA in Pittsburgh, and an MC came, and there were beauty queens, there were floats, all kinds of things in this little town. My father also was very, very active in the local church, and he would pick up people in his mail route and bring them to church. If there were children who didn't have a way to come to Sunday school, he brought them. And today, I can't think of the man's name, but he's become sort of a music star. It may be religious music, I'm not certain, but anyway, I was told that he was one of those little children my father picked up and brought to Sunday school. He was a lay leader, he was a song leader, he had a wonderful baritone voice. And I can look back and I can see the stability of our lives, largely because of his Christian faith. Of course, he was human. He made some errors. He did some stupid things. But he was the closest to anyone I've ever met who consistently embodied Jesus Christ's love and help to others. You know, we all missed him when he died because he was sort of a rock, a quiet rock, but he was jovial and humorous. We like to be around him. And I think that's very important in the days to come. And the many neighbors were like this, too, in that little area. And I think that we need to get back to that. We need to get our kids and our grandkids off some of those smartphones. We need to take them out in nature. We need to have some neighborliness. It's very important, and you can cultivate this. Well, we were starting to talk about this period that was the Little Ice Age, 1300 to 1870, and when we gave you some of this information on our previous program, we were a little bit puzzled because the writer of this, and we were looking at environmental history resources, and it was the Little Ice Age from 1300 to 1870, and when they talked about how cold this was, they said that there was widespread crop failure, famine in some regions, population decline, and yet they talked about this was a time that things began to flourish in the 17th and 18th centuries with expanding agriculture and large-scale land reclamation in the Netherlands and England. And we were kind of puzzled by this. We thought that that was like a little bit of a contradiction. And right after that, Lou, we looked at our local weather and we found something happening at the Great Lakes. Would you tell us all about that?
Yes, Great Lakes are pretty well frozen, and commerce has come to a halt in many of them, same with Chesapeake Bay, same with a great many places, so that you just can't, you can't carry on the usual commerce.
And you remember what they were doing, the Coast Guard, describe that, the 8 feet ice?
They had a Coast Guard cutter, an icebreaker, and they were slowly but surely breaking up the ice to try to make a channel for ships to carry vital supplies. Fuel, other supplies, food in some cases. Many of those small towns and cities along the way depended upon transportation by ship to get supplies in. So with the ice blocking those travel lanes for the boats, it was a situation where a lot of the things just wouldn't get through, a lot of needed supplies.
And in this little article here on the Little Ice Age, we're just going to review a little bit here what it was like. Then we're going to get into what was it really like the year without a summer in 1816. I think you're going to find that very interesting. During the height of the Little Ice Age, it was in general about 1 degree Celsius colder than at present. The Baltic Sea froze over, as did most of the rivers in Europe. Winters were bitterly cold and prolonged, reducing the growing season by several weeks. These conditions led to widespread crop failure, famine, and in some regions, population decline. The prices of grain increased, and wine became difficult to produce in many areas, and commercial vineyards vanished in England. Fishing in northern Europe was also badly affected as cod migrated south to find warmer water. Storminess and flooding increased, and in mountainous regions, the tree line and snow line dropped. In addition, glaciers advanced in the Alps and northern Europe, overrunning towns and farms in the process. Now, we're reviewing some of what we presented the last time. Iceland was one of the hardest hit areas. Sea ice, which today is far to the north, came down around Iceland. In some years, it was difficult to bring a ship ashore anywhere along the coast. Grain became impossible to grow, and even hay crops failed. Volcanic eruptions made life even harder. Iceland lost half of its population during the Little Ice Age. Tax records in Scandinavia show many farms were destroyed by advancing ice of glaciers and by meltwater streams. Travelers in Scotland reported permanent snow cover over the Cairngorm Mountains in Scotland at an altitude of about 1,200 meters. In the Alps, the glaciers advanced and bulldozed over towns. Ice-dammed lakes burst periodically, destroying hundreds of buildings and killing many people. As late as 1930, the French government commissioned a report to investigate the threat of the glaciers. They could not have foreseen, and now I won't read that last sentence again about human-induced global warming. I just cannot bring myself to read that lie. No. Now let's move right on to year without a summer, according to Wikipedia.
The year 1816 is known as the year without a summer. Also, the poverty year, the summer that never was, the year there was no summer, and 1800 and froze to death. Because of severe climate abnormalities that caused average global temperatures to decrease by 0.4 to 0.7 degrees Celsius, or the equivalent 0.7 to 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit. This resulted in major fruit shortages across the northern hemisphere. Evidence suggests the anomaly was predominantly a volcanic winter event caused by the massive 1815 eruption of Mount Tambora in the Dutch East Indies, Indonesia, the largest eruption in at least 1,300 years. The year without a summer was an agricultural disaster. Historian John D. Post has called this, quote, the last great subsistence crisis in the Western world, unquote. The unusual climatic aberrations of 1816 had the greatest effect on most of New England, Atlantic Canada, and parts of Western Europe. Typically, the late spring and summer of central and northern New England and southeastern Canada are relatively stable.
And, Lou, we interject from another source here, The Year Without Summer by Lee Foster, meteorologist. We interject the other cause besides that volcanic eruption. So what caused this unusual weather during the summer of 1816? Some believe it was caused by sinners, while others even blamed it on Benjamin Franklin's lightning rod experiments. However, climate data obtained from trees, ice cores, marine sediment, and historical documents indicate 1816 was part of a mini ice age that lasted from 1400 to around 1860. During this time, lower solar output produced harsh winters, shorter growing seasons, and drier climates, which were blamed for a host of human suffering and crop failures, such as the Irish potato famine. Now, I wouldn't be sitting here if that hadn't happened, because my ancestors, through my father's mother, where I was related to James Whitcomb Riley, the homespun poet, they came from Ireland because of that Irish potato famine. Another possible cause was the eruption of the Tambora volcano on the island of Sumbawa in Indonesia on April 15, 1815. The eruption lasted 1 week and rumbled for 3 months. The mountain elevation dropped from 14,000 feet to 9,000 feet, killed close to 10,000 people on the island, and another 80,000 people would eventually die from starvation and diseases related to the eruption. Tambora was one of the largest recorded eruptions, with estimates of 1.7 million tons of dust put into the air, equaling 6 million atomic bombs. The theory is that the dust reached the northern hemisphere during the 1816 reducing solar output. Now, I believe that there was something more about the effect of the sun when I first looked at this, and perhaps I'm not seeing it now about the solar minimum, but I believe we'll be getting into that more a little later. Go back to your descriptions there, Lou. Let's find out more about what it was like.
Typically, the late spring and summer of central and northern New England and southeastern Canada are relatively stable. Temperatures, average of both day and night, average between about 68 and 77 degrees Fahrenheit, 20 and 25 degrees Celsius, and rarely fall below 41 degrees Fahrenheit. Summer snow is an extreme rarity. In the spring and summer of 1816, a persistent, quote, dry fog, unquote, was observed in parts of the eastern U.S. The fog reddened and dimmed the sunlight, such that sunspots were visible to the naked eye. Neither wind nor rainfall dispersed this fog. It has been characterized as a stratospheric sulfate aerosol veil. At higher elevations, where farming was problematic in good years, the cooler climate did not quite support agriculture. In May 1816, frost killed off most crops in the higher elevations of New England and New York. On June 6, snow fell in Albany, New York, and Dennisville, Maine. Many commented on the phenomenon. Sarah Snell Bryan of Cummington, Massachusetts, wrote in her diary, "Weather backward." That's in quotes.
And here's still another very formidable article here on Year Without a Summer. I think this gives us a big overview, a worldwide view, and it does get into the weak solar maximum. Let's see, where does this come from? Year Without a Summer by Willie Soon, S-O-O-N, and Stephen H. Yaskell, Y-A-S-K-E-L-L. Is there a website there, Lou, for that?
No, I got it from the Internet.
But you can look it up, Year Without a Summer.
The year 1816 is still known to scientists and historians as 1800 and froze to death, or the year without a summer. It was the locus of a period of natural ecological destruction not soon to be forgotten. During that year, the northern hemisphere was slammed with the effects of at least two abnormal but natural phenomena. These events were mysterious at the time, and even today, they are not well understood. First, 1816 marked the midpoint of one of the sun's extended periods of low magnetic activity called the Dalton Minimum. This particular minimum lasted from about 1795 to the 1820s. It resembled the earlier Maunder Minimum, which was from about 1645 to 1715. That was responsible for at least 70 years of abnormally cold weather in the northern hemisphere. The Maunder minimum interval is sandwiched within an even better known cool period known as the Little Ice Age, which lasted from about the 14th through the 19th centuries. But the event that most severely shaped 1816's cold phenomena was a catastrophic eruption the previous year of Tambora on the island of Sumbawa, in modern-day Indonesia. The ash clouds and sulfur aerosols spewed by this volcano were widespread, chilling the climate of the northern hemisphere by blocking sunlight with gases and particles. A third factor could also have played a role. During both the Dalton and the Maunder minima, the sun shifted its place in the solar system, something it does every 178 to 180 years. During this cycle, the sun moves its position around the solar system's center of mass. This particular trick of gravity is known as inertial solar motion. Scientists have not yet confirmed whether or not inertial solar motion affects Earth's climate directly, but it remains a possibility. The combined influences of the sun's changes in magnetism, a major volcanic eruption, and possibly even the wobbling of the sun's position were responsible for famine, drought, and destructive snows and rains in the Northern Hemisphere in 1816. Diary entries and newspaper accounts abound of the unusual spring and summer cold. People even noted the sky's abnormal color, the large sizes of sunspots, and other curiosities. Because most people in the Northern Hemisphere were subsistence farmers, crop failure meant not only hardship but often death. Crop yields in parts of America and Europe sank dangerously low for a year, causing eyes to focus on a blotchy sun and an angry god, or both. A miserable summer. The people who survived the drought and cold would long after refer to 1816 as 1800 and froze to death. Sleet fell on the northeastern United States, and snowdrifts remained 2 feet deep in late spring. In Franconia, New Hampshire, 88-year-old physician Edward Holyoake, an amateur astronomer and meteorologist who kept detailed weather records for 80 years, wrote on June 7th, "Exceedingly cold." This is a quote, "exceedingly cold, ground frozen hard, and squalls of snow through the day. Icicles 12 inches long in the shade at noonday," unquote. Nobody could recall such a cold spring. Sheep froze in meadows, and small birds were easily caught by reason of the cold, or were found dead in fields. Massachusetts physician William Bentley wrote on June 12th, "In few seasons have we heard more bitter complaints against cold weather than since June has come in." Others recorded killer droughts and a strange tepid dryness wafting on northwest winds. A vivid impression of the summer, that summer in the northeast U.S., appeared in verse. "The trees were all leafless, the mountains were brown, the face of the country was scathed with a frown, and bleak were the hills, and the foliage sere, as had never been seen that time of the year." A certain degree of normalcy returned for part of the summer. In some coastal areas, the weather was, quote, "bland and agreeable if humid," unquote. Spreading vegetable growth could fool anyone, even astute longtime weather observers like Holyoake. Holyoake described June 7th to August 17th as, quote, "uniformly fine," unquote. He wrote in a confident hand that the crop outlook was better than could have been anticipated. But then the cold struck again. On August 21st, Holyoake wrote in a tenser hand, recording the frosts and snows that killed off the meager bean and corn crop. The difference between August 17th and 21st was like summer compared with winter. The fields were, quote, "as empty and white as October," unquote. This particular damaging frost affected areas from southern Canada to North Carolina. Cold struck again on September 11th, and people tended fields as if dressed for December. In an age characterized by back-breaking labor, the, quote, unquote, "poverty year," as 1816 was called by some, was a harrowing ordeal. The bad weather wasn't confined to North America. The summer weather in parts of Europe was so bad that it reminded people of November. On June 16th, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley noted that the weather at Lake Geneva turned abruptly from dry and beautiful to lashing rain with howling winds and vicious lightning storms. Shelley was spending the cold and rainy summer in Switzerland with various literati.
Yes, and we might think about these parallels to our time. If this gets a lot worse, what are going to be some of the repercussions? We've already seen things happen at our grocery stores when people think the shelves are going to be empty, and we've seen people actually killed in Walmart trying to get over each other on Black Friday. One of these things that happened here, these cool temperatures and heavy rains, got the failed harvests coming in there in Britain and Ireland, and families in Wales traveled long distances as refugees begging for food. And this famine in northern and southwest Ireland after the wheat, oats, and potato harvest failed. And in Germany, the crisis was very severe. Food prices rose sharply, and people demonstrated in front of grain markets and bakeries, and later riots, arson, and looting took place in many European cities. And it was the worst famine of 19th century Europe, according to the Wikipedia article. Lou, continue what you have.
And speaking of Mary Shelley, it says most, this is in Switzerland, were confined indoors on the stormy June 27th.
And some people listening may not know who Mary Shelley was. Why don't you tell what her claim to fame is?
Yes, it's going to say that in just a second here. And it says they were telling rounds of ghost stories. One of them, by the way, was Lord Byron as well. They were companions there with a couple of other literary personalities. And they pledged to record these fables on paper. And Mary Shelley was the first to prevail by 1818. As a fruit of her labors, we have the Gothic chiller Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus.
And if you recall, one of these articles said that some people thought this was due to sinners. If you really look into the lives of Shelley, Byron, you'll be very, very shocked. All the horrible decadence and immorality is not just in our times. And we can see now, as Lou and I get a little older, we can see a lot of people who looked initially on the top, and they're beginning to fall. Some of them are getting very sick. Some of them are just not doing well. Their families have abandoned them because they didn't care and because they weren't under Jesus Christ. It is a very special legacy that you can give your family. What is the verse, Lou? As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I might have it a little bit out of sync, but that's the idea. You have to make this choice. And whatever times we live in, God will protect his own. It's very clear. Well, what about the solar maximum? It was pretty strange then, wasn't it? Just like we've had this strange minimum here.
That's right. First, let's focus on how the sun made 1816 a bad year. The Dalton and Maunder minima were extended periods of very weak solar activity, spanning about 25 years and 70 years, respectively. Records from these periods show far fewer sunspots than normal, meaning the sun's magnetic activity was very weak during those years. Even though the sun is covered by relatively few dark sunspots when it is not magnetically active, it also has fewer bright regions known as plages and faculae. Sustained periods of weak magnetic activity make the sun slightly dimmer, so Earth receives less solar light energy. Scientists have recently reconstructed this weak magnetic activity by measuring various chemical isotopes in tree rings, for example, and matching them to weather and temperature oddities. Cosmic rays transmute nitrogen-14 in Earth's upper atmosphere, creating the radioactive isotope carbon-14. In the 1970s, solar astronomer John Eddy of the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, showed that carbon-14 concentration in annual tree growth rings is higher when fewer sunspots blemish the sun's surface. There's an astronomical explanation for this linkage. Strong magnetic activity in the sun is passed on to the solar wind, a stream of protons and helium nuclei flowing outward from the sun at high speed. A strong magnetic field in the solar wind shields Earth from cosmic rays. Because fewer cosmic rays collide with Earth, less carbon-14 forms in the atmosphere. But when solar magnetism is weak, more galactic cosmic rays can reach Earth and make more carbon-14. The carbon-14, in turn, combines with oxygen molecules in the atmosphere to make the heavy version of carbon dioxide that will ultimately be incorporated into the cellulose of growth rings of living trees. Suspiciously, 19th century eyes turned toward an angry god and at the sun. Fingers pointed to a spotty sun as the culprit for the strange and unpredictable weather. In 1816, sunspots were so large that they could be seen without telescopes. One report notes the presence of particularly large sunspots from May 3rd to 10th, and again on June 11th when a dry fog due to Tambora's effects reddened and dimmed the disk of the sun. This reddened condition acted as a solar filter and made the large sunspots stand out easily, even to unaided eyes. The sunspots made quite an impact on the average person, who, quote, at the time believed that the large spots appearing on the sun's disk lessened the number of rays of light, and consequently the Earth was to that extent cooler than usual, wrote Sidney Perley in the 1891 book Historic Storms of New England. The dark spots certainly dimmed sunlight, but the spots alone couldn't explain the unseasonable cold and snow. If sunspots were the only culprit, the cooling effects from the reduced sunlight should have come and gone through each 27-day solar rotation. In addition, large sunspots seldom last longer than a month, which would otherwise be necessary to explain the extended period of cooling. Ironically, 1816 occurred around the maximum of the sun's 11-year sunspot cycle. But the sunspot groups counted in 1816 amounted to a mere 35 as opposed to about 100 for a normal year around solar maximum. This is about the lowest sunspot maximum ever recorded, so astronomers call it a weak solar maximum. A person on the street might have accused the sun of causing the bad weather, but sunspots alone weren't doing the chilling and killing. We must look deeper for the culprit and right into the sun's magnetic cycles. The cause of the sun's magnetic activity cycles is still a pressing research topic. Inasmuch as 1816 was a weak solar maximum, the question lingers of how much the dim sun affected global cooling. But compared with Tambora's eruption, the sun played just a minor role in cooling Earth, at least for that year. Still, the sun's cooling effects could have gradually begun long before 1816. Tambora's eruption activity peaked on April 10th and 11th, 1815. Approximately 90,000 people perished on and around Sumbawa Island in the Java Sea, many from famine in the eruption's aftermath. Tambora's eruptive force, mortality, and atmospheric impact exceeded anything like it on Earth in the past 10,000 years. The catastrophic eruption was so powerful that it sheared Tambora nearly in half, from 4,300 to 2,850 meters. Tambora's dust funnel pumped 200 megatons of dust, rock, and aerosols into the stratosphere. In the immediate aftermath, violent winds blew throughout the area, and pumice chunks, 20 centimeters long, rained down on the surrounding region. Now, 20 centimeters, that would be, good 5 or 6 inches, I would think. Pretty big when you stop to think about it raining down on top of you. Floating ash islands formed in the sea, and a tsunami ravaged nearby shorelines. Darkness covered the area for days, with hot and cold air pockets wafting about. All of this destruction occurred far from European and American eyes, but astronomers throughout Europe observed dimmer stars in 1815, most significantly from September 6th to 20th. On these days and at later times, people in different locations around the world saw strikingly beautiful sunsets characterized by red, white, and yellow bands. These spectacular sunsets resulted from volcanic aerosols and dust thrown into the troposphere and stratosphere. Similar effects were seen worldwide from the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, but on a much smaller scale. even though Benjamin Franklin noted the connection between cool, dim years and volcanic activity as early as 1784, there has been no documented evidence that the scientists or the public of 1816 made the same link between Tambora's eruption and their unusual weather. Ironically, the northern hemisphere had been experiencing a temporary warming temperature excursion prior to the eruption, rising from an earlier cooling trend that could have thrown the scientists off track. Sulfate aerosols, aerosol particles, made from volcanic gas and dust, block some of the sun's heat. Scientists today generally agree that these aerosols were the main culprit of the year without a summer. The atmospheric ash affected some regions more heavily than others. The reconstructed regional pressure map for 1816 suggests that the volcanic aerosol clouds made the air pressure at sea level drop significantly across the North Atlantic's mid-latitudes, pushing displaced southward, that is, pushing mid-latitude cyclone tracks southward. A low-pressure zone that today sits over Iceland was displaced southward over England, which brought in wetter weather over Western Europe. Weather maps restored by the late British climatologist Hubert Lamb indicate that the average latitude of subpolar Icelandic low-pressure centers in July from 1811 to 1820 was about 61 degrees north. In contrast, when sunspots were in higher abundance between 1925 and 1934, the low-pressure center was displaced some 6 degrees farther north. In cases where the temperature was cold enough that summer, such as the northeastern United States, snow started to fall in June and often failed to melt. A dimmer sun could have helped spread or move the center for the North Atlantic low-pressure system sufficiently southward from Iceland to the British Isles to intensify volcanic dust and aerosol effects from Tambora. Cool polar air also could have penetrated farther south toward eastern North America in the Dalton Minimum. Considering these factors, it's easy to see how Tambora's eruption, combined with weak solar activity, could work together to make terrible or just weird weather and unusual sunset colors in and around 1816. Recent research by Tim Ball, Mike Chenoweth, Dick Harrington, Cynthia Wilson, and other scientists has expanded the recording of anomalous conditions in 1816 to Greenland, Alaska, northeast Brazil, the tropical Atlantic, the eastern Pacific by the Galapagos Islands, India, Tibet, South Africa, and elsewhere. The wobbling sun. Were other factors at work, adding to the reduced solar flux and to the terrible ill effects from Tambora? The sun's position in space moves about the solar system's center of mass, or barycenter, in cycles that repeat themselves every 178 to 180 years. This wobbling motion is caused by the gravitational tug of the planets, mainly Jupiter and Saturn, and is similar to the stellar motions that Jeff Marcy, Paul Butler, Michelle Mayer, Didier Queloz, Bob Noyes, Pete Nicenson, and other astronomers observe to detect extrasolar planets. Important years pertinent to this article for inertial solar motion, the barycenter shift, are 1632, 1811, and 1990. What's the connection then between inertial solar motion and a cold 1816, the eruption of Tambora aside? Inertial motion theory supporters state that perhaps it is no accident that the timing of the first 2 years, 1632 and 1811, corresponds to the two weakest sunspot activity periods ever recorded, 1645 to 1715, the Maunder Minimum, and 1795 to 1823, the Dalton Minimum. This correlation suggests that the 1816 events can be linked to the sun's motion around the barycenter. But just how are they linked, if at all, is another matter altogether. In addition, some studies suggest direct connections, without the sun's radiation intervening, between the sun's inertial motion dynamics and phenomena on Earth such as earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, massive rainfall, surface air temperatures, and so on. It must be emphasized that from a quote-unquote hard science perspective, nobody has identified any plausible physical mechanisms to support this unproved but intriguing hypothesis. We must ask more insightful questions in order to offer explanations for the many phenomena exhibited by the sun's magnetic field. One solar inertial motion model predicts that a prolonged solar magnetic activity minimum will occur somewhere between 1990 and 2013. This prolonged minimum is expected to end around 2091. That solar activity has direct or consistent control over Earth's climate. But when specific natural phenomena align, as was the case in 1816 with the sun in Tambora, adverse effects can affect Earth's climate and population in the short term. The bad weather in 1816 occurred at a period in human history when science literacy was on the rise. But like dentistry and surgery at the time, scientific knowledge was still rather primitive and thinly spread among the populace. Matters like baryocinder shifts and 11-year sunspot cycles were still unknown. Even Benjamin Franklin's pithy geophysical observations were ignored.
And bringing it up right to the present, the Daily Caller here has a paper, Global Warming, More Like Global Cooling, Michael Bastash, B-A-S-T-A-S-E-H, Bastash, I believe that is. A new paper claims that declining solar activity since 1998 could mean falling global temperatures in the years ahead, contrary to predictions of rapid warming made by virtually all climate models. And again, they're talking about this decreasing solar activity since 1998. And a physicist with the German-based European Institute for Climate and Energy, Jürgen Langhein, says from the stagnation of temperature, he said that since 1998 was caused by this decreasing solar activity. Quote, from 1900 to 1998, solar radiation increased by 1.3. Lou, I can't read that. W?
Well, let's see now. Get some scientific abbreviations here. I guess it would be 1.3, I don't know if W is watts. Anyway, it's per square meter. It's a measurement of the radiation.
But since 1998, it has diminished and could reach values similar to those of the early 20th century. A drop in global temperature over the next few years is predicted, Hein wrote. Hein argues that warming during the 20th century was not caused by increasing carbon dioxide emissions, but instead by increasing solar activity, changes in cloud cover caused by cosmic rays, and huge amounts of cloud condensation nuclei in the atmosphere from the nuclear weapons tests conducted from 1945 to 1963. And we know that the climate scientists, you see, have said this is all because of carbon dioxide emissions, but Hein says the connection between carbon dioxide and temperature is only superficial. And a lot of things are superficial, a lot of lies, a lot of brainwashing. Don't take those vaccines without knowing a lot more and then making a prayerful decision. So much is important here. We can't give it all to you here, but this high sunspot activity has the periods of warming, the period between 1950 and 1998, but are we heading into a little ice age? We're going to be watching all of this. Pennsylvania State University climate scientist Michael Mann says that we are at least having a temperate natural cooling cycle from the ocean. We think it's much more than that. We think it's the sun. Well, tune in to the Divided Kingdom again next week. You'll be hearing possibly Al Cuppet on biblical numerology. Thank you. Good night.